gracias. Bonsoir et bienvenue et merci d'être ici ce soir avec nous dans ce lieu magnifique. Vous êtes vraiment tous très impressionnants avec la lumière là, qui passe par les vitraux Tiffany. C'est vraiment très beau du stage de vous voir tous. It's a remarkable gathering and a remarkable gathering because when I look around, I see the faces of friends, colleagues, and a lot of people who love McGill. I'd like to recognize a few people. Je vais reconnaître, vous présenter en fait deux personnes très importantes. Notre chancelier, Arnold Steinberg. Et le président du Conseil des gouverneurs, Kip Cobet. Je dois vous souligner qu'il y a beaucoup de membres de ma famille qui sont ici ce soir. Je n'ai pas besoin de vous les présenter, même sans voir leur nom, là, leur petite étiquette avec leur nom. Vous allez les reconnaître, c'est des Fortiers. On a un petit air de famille. I think you all know how happy I am to be returning to McGill and to Montréal. Et je voulais que ce soir, on ait une célébration de Montréal. Parce que pour moi, Montréal est une ville qui est vraiment un carrefour du savoir et de la créativité. A vibrant city where knowledge and creativity meet. Et le carrefour du savoir et de la créativité est vraiment un lieu extraordinaire. It is where we make our greatest steps forward, our quantum leaps in all areas. And it leaves us amazed and inspired by the realization of the limitless possibilities of the human mind. Tonight, we have the privilege and pleasure of hearing the thoughts of six innovative thinkers, and they come from diverse areas: engineering and art, biotechnology and music, history and health. Some of them went very far away out in space to bring their talents and their knowledge. Les six panélistes sont tous des grands amis de l'Université McGill et des amis de qui nous sommes très fiers. Et à partir de demain, ils seront tous des diplômés de McGill. Eleanor Wachtel will introduce the panel in a minute, but I would like to say a few words about Eleanor. She's a Montreal native and a graduate of McGill University. She's a very talented interviewer that many of you, I'm sure, know from her long-running weekly CBC radio show, Writers and Company. During the past 23 years, she has interviewed established literary heavyweights and rising stars. She's a great champion of Canadian literature and is also tuned into the global scene. Her curiosity and inquisitiveness are not limited to literature. As host of the aptly named Wachtel on the Arts, she has also proven herself fluent in film, music, painting, and all matters of creative expression. Kazuo Ishiguro, the Man Booker Prize-winning author of The Remains of the Day, and someone very familiar with the art of interview, has said, Eleanor Wachtel is one of the very finest interviewers of authors I've come across anywhere in the world. And so we are incredibly fortunate to have her with us this evening and to guide the conversation. So please join me in welcoming Eleanor as a moderator for tonight's panel.
To be here, to moderate, and to celebrate the installation of Suzanne Fortier, and I would like to now invite the distinguished panel to join me on the stage. Whoa. Principal Fortier has chosen the subject for today's discussion, where knowledge and creativity meet, and further, the relationship between McGill and Montreal. All six people on the platform themselves embody the topic where knowledge and creativity meet. So I've asked them to address this from their own particular personal perspective in response to some questions that I've put to them. And since there are detailed biographies in the program, and it would take virtually all the time we have to adequately introduce them, I'll just offer a few brief introductory remarks before each speaker begins. And we'll start with a round on knowledge and creativity, and then move to the subject of Montreal and McGill. So to begin, astronaut Julie Payette was born in Montreal in 1963. As she just declared, she is the 12th generation Montrealer. She graduated with a Bachelor of Electrical Engineering from McGill and did a Master's in Computer Engineering at the University of Toronto. In 1992, the Canadian Space Agency selected Julie from 5,330 applicants to become one of four astronauts. In preparation for space mission assignment, she obtained her commercial pilot license, studied Russian, and logged more than 120 hours as a research operator on board reduced gravity aircraft. She moved through the ranks, and from 2000 to 2007, she was chief astronaut for the Canadian Space Agency. She flew two space missions and was the first Canadian astronaut to participate in a mission to construct the International Space Station. Last summer, Julie Payette left the CSA to become head of the Montreal Science Centre. Please welcome Julie Payette.
Merci, merci Eleanor. Bonsoir mesdames et messieurs, bonsoir Suzanne Fortier, famille. Quel plaisir d'être ici pour célébrer votre avènement comme rectrice de l'Université McGill. J'en suis extrêmement fière. But by posing a question about where creativity meets knowledge and knowledge meets creativity, it made me think, well, aren't these two opposite, right? It's like science and art. Yeah, you can't be a scientist and an artist, right? They're completely incompatible. We hear this a lot. We also hear that creative minds lack rigor or Cartesian minds lack imagination. It cannot be more of a fallacy. It's completely untrue. We know intrinsically that's where the two meet, that often something comes out. It is the foundation through which somehow progress, advancement of knowledge can then further blossom. Though some people would argue that sometimes a little less knowledge is good before you decide on taking a particular path. And one of the questions that Eleanor posed to us is, what made you take a particular direction? Well, in my case, I would say it's the lack of knowledge that put me where I ended up going somewhat. Because when you're growing up in this fabulous city of Montreal, as a little girl, you speak French, you have friends, and the world is somewhat your family, and my family is extremely large. I have 41 direct cousins, French-Canadian, of course. Then you feel that you're well-nurtured and life is all good. If I had known better, I may not have looked at a possible career choice the way I did. As I was watching in the early 1970s, the astronauts of the Apollo mission go to the moon, sitting on the floor of the gymnasium in my primary school, I was watching them on TV. You remember those TVs that they were rolled out on a tripod and they were like humongous? That's before you arrived. Lorna made this a lot smaller. We would watch them and I thought, wow, this is incredible. I want to do that. I want to put a spacesuit. I want to board the rocket. I want to blast off into space. And I want to drive that Jeep Rover on the moon. I have a Jeep now. That's the closest I got to that one. It didn't cross my mind at the time that I had about none of the characteristics of those guys I was watching on TV. I was a girl. I spoke a different language. I was from a different country. No one in my entire family had ever been in an airplane, including the 41 cousins and those that came after. And most people didn't travel much. But this is this lack of knowledge that gave way somewhat to wanting to look, wanting to be part of this unknown, this mystery out there, of wanting to create, of wanting to do something that no one had done before, somewhat. And then, fortunately, a few years later came the Olympics to the city of Montreal. And I know many of you probably have sound memories of this extraordinary time. What I remember, I was 13 years old in 1976, is that I realized that there was an extraordinary world out there, full of colors, full of different languages, full of mysteries and opportunity, a world that was just out there to explore. And again, perhaps my lack of knowledge made me think, wow, if I want to do this, then perhaps I have to build the building blocks that are necessary so you can spring. And that is what McGill offers every day of every year, constantly. It's those building blocks that make us better, that make us think, that make us develop our critical thinking and make wiser choices, that make us better human beings, education and knowledge. So I will complete this by, if you permit me, even though I'm an engineer through and through, to quote a very famous British poet named William Shakespeare, who said so rightly that knowledge is the wing wherewith we fly to heaven, if he only knew. Thank you.
I have a few follow-up questions, and one would be, what was the role of your parents or upbringing, do you think, in shaping your view of the world?
You know, as I'm a parent now, and so is Suzanne, and what do we want for our kids? For them to open up to the world and choose their path and find where, because we all have talents and opportunities, and I will thank, and I'm so grateful for my parents that when I did come home with ideas like that I wanted to fly on a rocket, or that I wanted to go to McGill, or that I wanted to move to Toronto.
Are the two equivalently fantastical? Flying in a rocket and going to McGill.
That they were open. They didn't say, no, you can't. They didn't say, well, you don't have what it takes. They don't say, well, you know, choose something else, really. And no, they said, okay, fine, that's what you want. Then work at it with effort. Everything is possible, and that is what I'm grateful for. I'm from a very modest family, very proudly so, but I was never told, no, you can't, until I went outside in the real world. And there I heard it quite a lot.
And what risks have you taken, do you think, personally, that enabled you to do what you're doing?
Risk? No risk at all. No. Space shuttle, they're real safe. Yeah. Well, I would say the risks, it depends how you define it. Perhaps going outside the comfort zone is perhaps one of the things that we all do. If you want to participate in making up of a society, somewhere, somehow, there will be an opportunity where you'll have to make a decision. Do I push this a little bit, or do I stay comfortably where I am? Do I sit comfortably at home on my sofa and just, I'm okay, life is not bad? Or do I just say, okay, there's an opportunity. Do I seize it? And there was an opportunity at many stages. We all get those. And I think sometimes the difference between achieving perhaps the goal that you've decided for yourself is to seize that opportunity when it comes through. So yes, when there is an ad in the paper that says, we are recruiting astronauts, and you're thinking, well, I'll never qualify. There's no certainties in life, but there's a few assurances. And one is that if you don't apply, you have a 100% chance of not being chosen. So try it.
And you're saying that, in a sense, the lack of knowledge was an aid to you, because had you known, and so on. And I think many people who've had particularly adventurous lives would say, had they known when they started what was involved, they may never have taken the first step. But is there a moment when you're conscious of creativity asserting itself and in terms coming more into play? Because obviously then you did get the knowledge you needed.
I was tongue-in-cheek at the beginning, saying that a Cartesian mind sometimes is thought as having no imagination, and vice versa, a creative mind might lack rigueur. Well, there was this one moment when I was choosing my first degree. I'm unlike Boris, who's the extraordinary musician, I am an amateur musician, but I was very attracted by the idea of doing a degree in music at McGill. And so I sat down, and for a minute, perhaps the more non-Cartesian part of my mind said, oh, that would be so much fun, and it would be so great. And then the Cartesian mind took over very quickly, because it was clear to me that I was not talented enough to make a decent living as an art, as a musician, as an artist. But I could definitely, because it's not hard, to make a living as a good engineer and then do music on the side. It's just to illustrate that the two are completely intertwined, and you can do both. So I ended up doing my engineering degree, but taking my electives.
You sang with the MSO, didn't you?
Among other things, but more importantly, with the Gibb Burton Sullivan Society at McGill University. But that was not a very important role. It's an anecdote to illustrate, again, we find those choices in our lives all the time, don't we? And that we can't always predict what's going to turn out. But I'll leave you with one last anecdote here, is that during the interview process in 1992 by the Canadian Space Agency to recruit new astronauts, we were a bunch of us trying to get one of those four spots. And in the last round of interview, when there was 20 left, they asked a similar question to everybody, and they asked me, just like the others, what in your previous life did you illustrate yourself as a team player? And my answer, and I regretted it on the moment and I don't today, was that I said that I'd been singing in choirs for 20 years. And therefore, clearly, I could follow direction. I was a very good team player. I could sing in harmony. I could say the right thing in the right place, be in tempo and everything else. And I thought, man, they're going to think I'm so stupid. But that was it. You never know what experience back in your life will serve you somewhere else, so broaden your horizons.
Thank you. Conductor and musician Boris Baroth was born in Montreal in 1944 into a musical family. He studied violin with his father and was something of a prodigy himself. He was only five when he was a soloist with the Montreal Symphony Orchestra at a young people's matinee. Baroth took courses at the Conservatoire and at McGill and studied with Pierre Monteux. When he was only 15, he founded the Philharmonic Youth Orchestra of Montreal and made his Montreal conducting debut at its head. He soon developed an international reputation, conducting in England as well as serving as assistant conductor to Leonard Bernstein and the New York Philharmonic. More recently, he's been conducting opera in Italy. Boris Broad is the conductor and artistic director of the McGill Chamber Orchestra, as well as the National Academy Orchestra in Hamilton. Widely recognized for his many achievements, tomorrow he will receive an honorary degree from McGill. It's my pleasure to present Boris Broad.
Alors, c'est vraiment un grand plaisir pour moi d'être ici parmi vous et je me trouve dans une compagnie assez distinguée et ça me gêne un petit peu. Et comme ça, je vais me cacher derrière ce podium en vous donnant mes remarques. J'aimerais d'abord remercier de tout cœur Mme Fortier, Dr. Fortier, qui m'a accordé cette grande honneur que je recevrai demain. Vraiment, je suis bouleversé par ça, parce que, évidemment, je suis Montréalais. Je suis né ici, dans une atmosphère francophone, je dois vous dire. Mais à l'âge de 5 ans que je suis allé à l'école, j'ai trouvé que je ne pouvais pas aller à l'école en français. En étant juif, j'étais autre. Et comme ça, j'ai dû poursuivre mes études en anglais.
And so that's why I'm going to talk to you in English today, because this is such a detailed subject, and I took Eleanor at her word and decided to truly do some research and to prepare a bit of a script for you. Knowledge is a compendium of the proved, while creativity is using the proved or imagined to go beyond. It's the unquenchable thirst to expand the known for better, for deeper, to risk, to be on the edge without a safety net. And Judy knows about that. Both are inextricably connected, though one does not necessarily supersede the other in importance. They touch when met, they're moving targets. Creativity doesn't follow straight lines. It'd be wonderfully predictable to say that creativity always follows knowledge, or that success in academia is a reliable predictor of creativity, but this is certainly not the case. Creativity is often going against the system. Sparks fly. Friction seems to be an important part of the creative process. I'm a musician, and so my views in this distinguished company must be to speak to what I've experienced as an artist and what I view from the musical entrepreneur's perspective. I was born into a family of musicians who are also musical trailblazers. Until I was 7, my father, Alexander Brott, composer, violinist, conductor, my mother, Lotte Brott, cellist, manager, filled my ears, even before my birth, with creations musical. Je vais vous raconter maintenant une petite anecdote. Quand j'étudiais le violon, quand j'ai fait mes premières études de musique de chambre, j'étais dans un quatuor. Et j'ai trouvé ça vraiment étrange parce que je ne connais pas en mémoire de partie de certaines œuvres, mais la partie violoncelle. Et je me disais, comment est-ce que c'est possible? Alors j'ai demandé à ma mère, comment ça se fait que je connais vraiment à mémoire la partie de violoncelle, même que moi je suis violoniste. Elle était très organisée, Lotte, et elle regardait dans les programmes, et dans le dernier trimestre de sa grossesse, elle a joué ces mêmes œuvres. Alors j'étais très proche du violoncelle, évidemment, dans le ventre de ma mère. Alors, j'ai appris par cœur le parti de violoncelle et pas celle de violon. We lived and worked together in one room, the living room of my parental grandparents' apartment in a fourth-floor walk-up on Maplewood Avenue. I was witness to hours of investigation, practice, and the trying out of new, strange sounds. It was, as it turns out, an inescapable fate that I, too, become a musician. When I was 5, as Eleanor said, Wilfred Pelchi invited me to solo on the violin with Les Concerts Symphoniques de Montréal at a matinée symphonique and asked my father to write the work I was to perform. As the work was being written, I was required to perform excerpts each week for an assemblage of teddy bears arranged on the living room couch, all sporting bow ties. The performance day arrived, and I made my way from the wings at the Auditorium du Plateau. I don't know how many of you have ever been to l'Auditorium du Plateau, but it's a little high school. And when I think of what took place in that little high school during my life, Uncle Pelly, as I was encouraged to call him, asked me what it was like to play a new piece by my father. My response was, it was fun. Except as soon as I had learned a passage, my father kept changing the notes. From my beginnings, my parents were never judgmental, though they challenged constantly. They encouraged me and eventually my younger brother Dennis to challenge everything, but always with reasoned argument. They abhorred hero worship. They were constantly challenging the status quo and convinced me to do likewise. As I grew up, a parade of musical greats trudged up the steps of our modest duplex on Earnscliffe Avenue. Enesco, Beecham, Menuhin, Oistrakh, Munch, Pierre Monteux, Jean-Pierre Rampal, to name just a few. They all came to dinner, and though I could hardly reach the table, I was expected to be part of the exchanges, verbal and musical. Of course, all this served me ill when I went to elementary school. I tried unsuccessfully to challenge my contemporaries and my teachers. I couldn't seem to get along with any of them. I decided to bring my violin to school for an assembly and play the first movement of Vivaldi's A minor violin concerto. It was a disaster. I was snowballed all the way home. So I hid at recess and I kept to myself. I guess this inspired me to devise anti-bullying education concerts around the subject of Beethoven and his experiences. My lessons at the McGill Conservatory were what I looked forward to. Pablo Picasso said that every child is an artist. The problem is being an artist when you grow up. Mozart certainly experienced this. His was a creativity that sprang up from within. Yes, he was taught the basics by his father, who also introduced him to Bach and Italian opera. Mozart's innovative style represents a synthesis of many different experiences, known elements, each taken for a while into his own idiom, and then in part rejected, in part absorbed. The fact that his father exploited his talents, touring him around the courts of Europe, aided his knowledge base by exposing him to all the great musicians and composers of his time. He wrote his first composition at the age of 5. He had an unusually acute ear and musical memory. He wrote for every known medium current in his time and is probably the most universal musician in the history of Western music. He did run into trouble when he could no longer be bounced on the knees of royalty. He was looked upon with great jealousy by adult composers of his time who recognized his genius and were envious of it. Mozart was also bumptious and simply didn't fit in with the dictates of society where musicians were treated as servants. He experienced great personal and professional hardship. His mature music is distinguished by melodic genius, simplicity of form, textures and harmonies of exquisite beauty. It speaks to the soul. For each creative person, the meeting point of knowledge and creativity is a constantly moving fulcrum. Creativity can be born from a dissatisfaction with current knowledge or an all-powerful curiosity for a new take on known material. It can be gentle or violent. In Mozart's case, it was, from my perspective, gentle. One might even call it Canadian, as I believe we Canadians are comparatively a gentle nation of evolutionary rather than revolutionary tendency. By contrast, Ludwig van Beethoven was much more violent in his break from tradition and much longer in the maturing process. Beethoven wrote far less music than Mozart, but his music was truly revolutionary. He broke the boundaries of tradition, expanded form, and ushered in the Romantic era. His creativity was a struggle, as witnessed by the notebooks he left behind, with myriad corrections and scratches that confounded his copyists and publisher. Beethoven was driven by a revulsion for the enslavery of the masses by royalty. Classical music was an embodiment of that culture of domination by the ruling class. The minuet thus became a scherzo, literally a joke, and Beethoven used repetitive motifs and stark harmonies to drive his point home with unheard of noisy impact. This endeared him to both the emerging non-royal public of ordinary people and to wealthy sponsors. Perhaps the ultimate joke. No less a composer than Richard Wagner hit away with Beethoven's 9 symphonies using the springboards of knowledge of the source of breaking new compositional ground. Albert Einstein said, imagination is more important than knowledge, for knowledge is limited to all we now know and understand, while imagination embraces the entire world and all there ever will be to know and understand. The history of music is filled with creators who were dissatisfied with present knowledge and found new roads with an increasing violence, so much so that it is completely divorced from the appreciation of all but a few conoscenti. Ultimately, being a conservative, not necessarily the Harper variety, and hugely Canadian, I think creativity must be a discipline. The talent comes in choosing what to accept and what to discard. Then there is the courage to present new ideas to a dispassionate world. Growing up, I was imbued with a belief that anything was possible. You just had to go for it. I had great dreams that great music could play an important role in making a world a better place. I still believe that. I've seen what music can do for youth and how it can change disadvantaged lives, as in the El Sistema program in Venezuela, which is now spreading worldwide. The German poet Goethe said that music begins where words end. From a musical perspective, creativity meets knowledge when, dissatisfied with the present or a new voice presents itself from somewhere, inexplicable, we're forced by the impulse to break forth courageously, to find new voices, new ways to join the intellect and the soul using an international language that connects all humanity. These words are just the beginning. The rest is a song.
Thank you. Neuroscientist Marc Tessier-Lavigne was born in Trenton, Ontario, but claims that had he been born in Montreal, he would have been a 13th generation Montrealer. He grew up in Europe, where his father was serving with NATO as part of the Canadian Armed Forces. Marc came back to Canada to study physics at McGill, and then went to Oxford as a Rhodes Scholar. He stayed on in England for his doctorate at the University College London. He taught at universities in California for more than a decade, and then took a job at the first and one of the leading biotech companies in the world, Genentech. He served as Executive Vice President for Research and Chief Scientific Officer. 3 years ago, he was named president of Rockefeller University in New York City, the first American institution devoted solely to biomedical research, with 73 laboratories, a team of 1,500 researchers, and 5 Nobel laureates on faculty. Please welcome Marc Tessier-Lavigne.
Merci Eleanor et merci aussi Suzanne Portier pour cette invitation d'être ici aujourd'hui. C'est vraiment un grand plaisir pour moi d'être ici parmi vous pour célébrer votre inauguration en tant que principal de McGill. It really is a pleasure and I bring greetings from New York and from the Rockefeller University on this joyous day here at McGill. I was particularly thrilled to accept the invitation when I heard the topic of the panel, where knowledge meets creativity. And there are two reasons why I was excited to think about that, and I was stimulated by this challenge. The first, in my role as president of Rockefeller University, it is a university that's just dedicated to biomedical research. But the culture that's been established over the past century is a culture that strives to do not just good science, not just excellent science, but really transformative science, try to encourage our faculty, to enable our faculty to make discoveries that will change the way we see the world. And this is counted in many ways. One metric that we do like to use at the university is to point out that over the century of its existence, Rockefeller's had more Nobel Prizes in medicine or chemistry than any other institution in the world. And in fact, if we're a country, it would be number 4 after the U.S., Britain and Germany, and ahead of France. So it's quite a remarkable institution, and the question is, how do you stimulate that kind of creativity and discovery? The other reason I was very excited to consider this topic is because I think it's something that weighs on our minds very much as educators. How do we teach our graduate students, and we're just a graduate research university, how do we teach them to become creative scientists? Is that taught, or is that something that's just innate? And in fact, it's for me it very close to home because as a teenager, I grew up in a family without scientists. I didn't meet scientists until I came to university, but somehow I knew I wanted to be a scientist. But I wondered, could I do it? Would I ever be able to make a discovery? How do scientists make discoveries? I'd read books about the lives of scientists and wonder, well, how did they come up with that? How did Einstein come up with relativity? And so I think it's a fascinating subject. It's one that mattered a lot to me, and it's one that we care about passionately with our students. I want to just change the framework for the discussion ever so slightly, though, but I think it's really blends with some of the previous comments, to consider not just knowledge and creativity, but rather how knowledge and creativity come together very specifically to enable scientific discovery and to enable transformative scientific discovery. So that's really what I want you to focus on. And I'll illustrate with a couple of examples, but in thinking about this, it seems to me that there are really three components to the process through which a scientist goes in order to make fundamental discoveries. And the first is really laying the groundwork, where the scientist becomes deeply immersed in their subject, gets to know the system, whether they're a cancer researcher trying to understand how cancer develops in a certain tissue or organ, whether they're a neuroscientist fascinated by Alzheimer's disease, trying to understand why nerve cells die in Alzheimer's disease, trying to understand how the genetic code is read out, how various pathogens evade the immune system. So the scientists will start by immersing themselves, and that is a time of knowledge. But it's not just book knowledge. It's deep practical knowledge through doing experiments and getting to know their system, their subject matter. If you're the neuroscientist working on Alzheimer's disease, understanding, looking down the microscope at nerve cells dying in response to the disease. And that lays the groundwork on which the scientist then builds to make the discoveries. But then comes the creative step. And the creative step involves several components. And this is not meant to be an exhaustive list, but it's some of the things that have to come together for there to be a truly transformative advance, at least in my view. The first is the scientist has to choose the right problem to work on. If you are too ambitious and shoot too high, you won't be able to get there. If you shoot too low, you may do something that will be nice and incremental, but not transformative. And the art of science, if you will, is choosing something in between, something that's ambitious enough, but not too ambitious. I heard a wonderful phrase recently. It's the art of the start. How do you choose where you're going to place your efforts? The other part of that, and an integral part of that, is for it not to be too ambitious, you have to have an idea about how you're going to tackle the problem. So it's a combination of choosing the problem, choosing the right problem, and then seeing a path through to solving that problem. So that's the first key step. But then what we would call creativity has to come into play. That's looking for irregularities in the data that provide clues that something might be different from what you thought. Looking for relationships between various findings that make you realize that this might just be one set of observations might actually be tied to another set of observations. In general, immersing oneself in the data to make sense of them, and importantly, as our first two speakers have said, being willing at any point to disregard accepted wisdom. If there's an irregularity, is it just noise in the data, or is it something different that people haven't seen before? Being willing to challenge, so knowledge is important to set the groundwork, but challenging that knowledge, I think, is an integral component of every important scientific discovery that's made. There's then, on top of that, a lot of trial and error. You go down lots of blind alleys, you try lots of different things, ways of getting at the problem. You might decide that the problem was just too difficult, and then you have to recast it into something that's more solvable. Science is the art of the solvable. And as part of that, at every stage, the scientists will be taking risks. They'll be taking risks in exploring avenues that might not be fruitful, lots of labor to explore facets of the problem that turn out to be uninteresting or mundane. Most of what we do in science fails. Most experiments fail. I think it's something that non-scientists don't realize, but most of what a scientist who's really trying to push the boundaries of knowledge attempts actually fails. But if you persist, you're willing to take those risks, you're willing to continue with the trial and error, and you're smart about it, then insights will come.
What constitutes being smart about it?
Smart about it being smart and tactical. When not hitting your head against the if there's a brick wall, don't, what they say, the definition of insanity is trying the same thing even if, over and over again, even if you know that it's not going to succeed. So if you're hitting you've hit a brick wall, realizing that you might want to step back and go around it, that would be being smart. So the insights will come, and then the next part, the third part, and just as important as the first two, is to take those insights and to run with them. The execution, the follow-through, is important. It's always tragic when a scientist makes a discovery and it just lies fallow because it isn't built up and isn't explored to the full. Those are the three parts: laying the groundwork, the creative act with all of those components, and then the follow-through. And I think you would find all of those strands in major scientific discoveries. It's worth reflecting here on some. Boris mentioned Einstein a few minutes ago and his wonderful statement that imagination is more important than knowledge. And that is true also in this scientific context, even more so perhaps in this scientific context. But Einstein also said that science is 1% inspiration and 99% perspiration. Often that's taken to mean that someone will have a brilliant idea and then they have to work it out. But he didn't actually mean that, or I don't think he meant that. The perspiration is at the beginning, the middle, and the end. You have that perspiration at the beginning to set up, to lay the groundwork. The inspiration comes through that hard work, and then you have to keep at it, building that inspiration, and then executing and going to the end. The other famous saying in science is Louis Pasteur, that chance favors only the prepared mind. Sometimes people remember that as chance favors the prepared mind, but he had the word only in there as well. Chance favors only the prepared mind. And so that preparation, laying the groundwork, is essential if you are to see suddenly a piece of data that makes sense, something that helps the breakthrough, and to grab onto that and build on that. I think those great thinkers provide us with some of the elements for thinking about this, but I think you need that whole journey, that whole path, for a scientist to be able to go the distance and make those profound discoveries.
You were saying when you grew up, you weren't exposed to science until university. How did you know it was what you wanted to make your life?
I loved mathematics, first and foremost, and I loved any subject that math touched on. So it was just a natural instinct or a natural impulse and love. I guess the focus on mathematics also got me interested in the other natural sciences bit by bit, first physics and chemistry and then biology eventually. Somehow at some level I knew that this is what I wanted to do. There was nothing else that really excited me that made me as passionate as learning about the world. So even though I wasn't brought up in a scientific environment, somehow I knew that I wanted to be a scientist. I just didn't really know what that meant.
And then once you knew what it meant, which was a great deal of failure, how did you find the resilience in yourself? Was it not discouraging, or how did you go forward from there?
Well, I think part of that is, and this perhaps goes back to my upbringing. My parents were always very supportive, but always pushing me and my siblings to
be passionate, to go for our passions. They didn't care what it was as long as we embraced our passions. So they supported me in my scientific endeavors, and I guess always provided a haven where we could retreat when, you know, inevitably failure was experienced. So perhaps upbringing, perhaps temperament. I think also I think in most scientists there's a drive to get to the answer, and that drive is so strong that it overcomes the failures that you have along the way. I should say, I don't think scientists are that different from many other people in many other fields. I think, you know, in music, in engineering, in the arts, anything important has required deep commitment, trial and error, a lot of failure. And so I don't think scientists have the monopoly on that by any means. But I do think it's part and parcel of the existence of scientists.
At NASA, we have a saying that says failure is not an option.
Did everyone hear that?
So that put it
Julie was saying at NASA they have a saying, failure is not an option. In Russia, they have a toast to the success of our hopeless mission. That's another story. Nathalie Bondil was born in Barcelona in 1967. She grew up in Morocco. Her parents are from Marseille. She is, as she says, a true Mediterranean girl. Her father worked for a French bank, Société Générale, and she says he would have loved for her to go into a bank. The youngest of four children, Nathalie moved to Paris to study at the École du Louvre and then won a place at France's Institut National du Patrimoine in order to become a curator. Her specialty is 19th century international art and sculpture. In 2000, she was appointed chief curator of the Montreal Museum of Fine Arts, and in 2007, its director. It's because of Nathalie that we're in this beautiful hall today. Just in the past few years, under her leadership, the musée has expanded dramatically, opening new pavilions in Canadian and contemporary art, decorative art and design, sculpture garden, and the conversion of this heritage church into a warm and welcoming concert hall. She's also spearheaded one successful show after another. The Jean-Paul Gaultier Show just opened in New York, the Peru Show in Seattle. The recent Chiuli Glass exhibit attracted more visitors than the Chinese Terracotta Army. Among her many honors, tomorrow Nathalie Bondil will receive an honorary degree from McGill. Please welcome her now.
Thank you, Eleanor. Thank you. Well, first of all, donc, I want to congratulate you, Suzanne. Merci beaucoup. Bravo pour cette installation. C'est vraiment extraordinaire de vous savoir ici, en très bonne vie, avec tous vos amis. Je vous expliquerai pourquoi après. Et surtout, je veux aussi mentionner la présence de Monsieur Steinberg, qui est évidemment donc le chancelier de votre université, mais aussi un grand collectionneur, grand donateur, aussi pour le Musée des Beaux-Arts de Montréal. Alors, je suis très très heureuse de vous accueillir, et un grand amateur de musique en plus, alors mon Dieu. Écoutez, c'est formidable de vous avoir ici, chez nous, chez vous, et je vous dirais que d'être avec autant de scientifiques autour de moi, je suis très impressionnée, parce que très franchement, je suis lamentable, donc je suis anumérique, comme on dit, and really, I must say that when I was a little girl, donc one of my dreams would have been to be a cosmonaut. Truly, this is why I'm very, very, very impressed to be with you today. And after that, I realized that my intergalactic ambition were really too big for me. And at one point, I said to my father, well, maybe I will be hôtesse de l'air. I said, well, it's like a serveuse de l'air. Oh, okay, so he was not very convinced, and I didn't have so much idea about what I would do, especially because I hate mathematics. But I must say that I'm very surprised because I share many of your ideas, so maybe I have to work. Yes, I'm very good. And in fact, it's maybe creativity and knowledge. It's because you don't know where you will go. And for me, maybe I always think that l'échec a toujours été une option. On the contrary of what you do. And it's exactly what happens here in this concert hall and with this museum, in the place where you are today. Maybe it seems obvious for you, but I can tell you that in 2008, when we bought the church, we didn't know at all what we would do with this nave. And we knew that there was this beautiful building, the fabulous national heritage from Montreal, and we had the idea to have this expansion in order to put the Canadian art collection. But with this fabulous room, we don't know at all what we would do. It is not possible to transform it into a museum because of some conservation climate issues. And we didn't know. So we say, okay, let's go and we'll see after, we'll find an idea to make this kind of multicultural, you know, une salle à tout faire, anyway. And just by chance, and you're right, because we always need chance, and not just one brand, but a company of brands. And so we met Pierre Bourgie. And Pierre Bourgie had this great idea, wanted to have a church for music. But he didn't want to buy a church and to have a new foundation because he understood immediately that it was too complex and maybe not a very good idea in for the long term. And so I said, well, we have this fabulous nave. He knew that there was a great potential of acoustic, which is true, and you don't have a professional. And so we decided to create this kind of hybridation of complex, of a new foundation dedicated to music, la Fondation Arte Musica, within a museum. And I must say that it's rather unique. I'm still trying to find another example, but really there is no other museum or fine arts museum which has a professional concert stage. So this is completely unique. If you have personne dans la salle, no? Okay, no, ça demeure unique. I'm very happy. And this is the way how to be creative. It's you have reality. You have a dream. Our option was really to expand the museum. And so by chance we met Pierre Bourgie, who works also with a very good professional, Isolde Lagacé, who leads the Fondation Arte Musica. And so we decided to share expertise and to invent a new life. In fact, it's a kind of marriage, so it's a wedding. And I must say that we could not have expected to have such a success. It's a completely, it's a great surprise for us because we didn't know at the very beginning how to mix arts, visual arts with music, even if I could say music belongs to sciences from the liberal arts because music was the way how to find harmony within the world. So it's a way to compare music with mathematics or senses, if I can find a way. And in fact, well, I'll try. But I would say that it's for us now, 5 years after the creation of the Fondation Arte Musica, we have this concert hall, and I must say that the professional people and are very happy, and we produce, or they produce, more or less, we present 150 concerts every year. It's completely crazy. We would have liked to have it for some other events, but in fact it goes so well that it is your new concert hall for the whole city. And I think that it says a lot about how to be creative, because at the beginning we didn't know. And I wanted to have in my programming and the exhibition programming for the museum this kind of crossing of disciplines with visual arts and music, from Warhol Life to Imagine, and now with music and art, with Venice and music will visit tonight. But it was really something, a work in progress. And I'm completely convinced with what you say. I do not believe in the deus ex machina, I have the idea, because you can have a very good idea at the beginning, but at the end it can be a very bad product. So it's always better to be to work with people, to have empathy. Empathy is very important. To put the project in the center of your attention, not egos, and to work with all kind of brands and all kind of expertise. And from the very very beginning until the very very good at the end. And this is the way how to be creative, because you gather around you the best people, and also you give to them the freedom to be creative, or to be entrepreneur. We are all entrepreneurs. Say, go, do what. And I must say that I'm spoiled, because I can have failure in my field. So I think that the. We are very lucky in arts, because there is no life between my hands. I'm not a surgeon, so I'm not a cosmonaut, so we can invent, we can try. And I think that this is a way how to belong to the race. And also, working with other brains, being empathic, it's also it's a way not to consider your city and your institution and your collaborations, not in terms of competitions, but really in terms of co-evolution. And we have to share this kind of evolution. I would say I would be very Darwinist, if I can say, which is very strange for French, but I'm also Canadian now. And so it's not just Lamarck. And it's true that it's exactly what you say. Sometimes you can develop some potentials. You don't know exactly what will be the end, but you have all the, this kind of serendipity, which is it's an English word, which is not translated into French. It is interesting. And so giving space, giving freedom to the people with who you, you work, helps you just to be more creative, and also not to consider that you are in competition with other institutions, but you are really all together in order to share to share your expertise. Once again, when we say the Homo sapiens is a kind of Homo economicus, economicus, eco, this is the home, habitat, eco. So you share your habitat, you share your home with the people with who you work. And what is important when you defend a project, it's the consequences you will have for the whole society, for the whole economy, for your whole city. And this empathy will help you to be more open-minded and to be more creative. So this
what
is the way.
What was your first exposure to creativity?
My first exposure, maybe to put one foot in front of the other. It works.
No, really, in terms of figuring out what you wanted to do in your life, your siblings are all very ambitious and accomplished, and what propelled you to undertake art, visual art, to be in a competitive way, to even get into the right schools in Paris, to study being a curator?
Frankly, I didn't know at all. And I still don't know what I want to do, tomorrow. So it's really, I follow some projects, I follow people, passions. I never considered that there is on one side a job and on the other side a passion. So I'm very much, I think, stimulated with the imagination, and because in imagination you have the word image, and so this is, I think that naturally I was attracted by the word of images. And because it talks to you not only in a more cognitive and or intellectual meaning, but also with a sensible meaning. It's a way through the image, through visual arts, you can embrace the world in a complete with a complete another knowledge. And I think that arts is so important and so essential, because it helps you not just to understand the world with with your brain, but really with your gut, with your heart. And it's absolutely essential. And especially now, because we are surrounded by images, and we are also manipulated by images. But if you don't know how to, si vous n'êtes pas le maître de l'image, c'est l'image qui va prendre contrôle sur vous. If you don't control the image, then the image will control you, yourself. So this is why donc, I think that it is so important to, and especially to work in a museum. After that, I can. It's just I'm very. Je m'ennuie très facilement. Donc maybe I'm not a specialist. I'm more generalist. So I like to. Je suis très gourmande de la vie. This is why I'm more creative.
Because on the face of it, people would think museum and art was had much more to do with creativity than knowledge. What's mm-hmm. your understanding of where they intersect?
I would say it's. I don't. Also, look, I don't think that it's a good division. It's a little bit too Manichaean. And I like very much this sentence said by Hubert Reeves. Another great spirit I admire. He said, "La science a du goût." Donc, science has taste. Moi, je dis, oh, extraordinaire. For me, science was really boring, like to be in a computer. And said, "Wow, but of course it's true." And for him, he said, "What will help you to go in this direction will also be donc, your limits." And it's true. And so you cannot. You have to always to think with your mind. With a lot of transpiration, but also with instinct, and it is not even possible to create a human being without those two dimensions. If not, you are a robot or a computer. I don't know. And so this is why the brain is still the more complex, one of the most complex engine which exists in the world. So.
So I liked something that Natalie said about what you said about the Venice show. You said Venice is a perfect balance between nature's melody and reason's harmony. Mm-hmm. And in a sense, that's a sort of an eloquent summation of the topic that we're entertaining this afternoon. Engineer and entrepreneur Laurent Trottier was born in Montreal in 1948. He studied at McGill, getting a bachelor's and then a master's in electrical engineering. He co-founded Matrox Electronic Systems, a major Montreal firm at the leading edge of graphics, video editing, and image processing. He's been a prominent philanthropist, especially with McGill and its Faculty of Science. In 2005, he also initiated the Laurent Trottier Public Science Symposium. It's a privilege to present Laurent Trottier.
Well, thank you. I'd just like to thank Suzanne Fortier for inviting me to participate in this panel today, and congratulations to you taking on this new role. This topic, where knowledge and creativity meet, is a pretty broad philosophical topic. I'll come at it a bit more from a personal standpoint, my own personal background. On occasions like this, I always like to tell the story about how I personally got hooked on electronics, which is what I do for a living, and science in general. It all started out when I was about 11 years old. I met a new friend whose hobby was electronics. And when I went over to his house for the first time, he showed me a couple of cool projects he'd built. He'd had an electric telegraph, and he built a crystal radio. He had an older brother that was into amateur radio, ham radio, and with this equipment, he could talk to people from all over the world. This was about 1960, before the internet and everything. And I was just fascinated by all these wonders. I got really hooked on that. I said, wow, I want to do stuff like that. So the first thing I did is I went to the public library and I took out every introductory book I could find on electricity, on electronics. I wanted to build my own radios and telegraphs, stuff like that. I wanted to know how things worked, how a radio works, how a television works. And in the same section of the library, I also discovered books on science. I learned that it's possible not only to understand how radios and television work, but how nature works. You know, what's the origin and evolution of life? What's the origin of our solar system, of the stars, of the galaxies, of the universe itself? I got hooked on science as well. And I've maintained that interest. That's sort of what I call it, an insatiable curiosity to understand how the world works. The famous planetary scientist, late scientist Carl Sagan, summed it up for me. He said, science teaches us the deepest mysteries of our origins, nature, and fate. Anyway, when I was about 13, one of my aunts asked me what I wanted to be when I grew up. I said, a scientist. She said, but what kind? Because then I realized that you can't be a general scientist. There's no such thing. You've got to specialize. So I chose my first love of science, which was electronics. But I've maintained that lifelong passion for science in general. And I think that curiosity about the world and how nature works and covers all aspects of science, I think that's helped make me a successful entrepreneur and innovator. There's that curiosity that keeps driving me to understand things. So in terms of another part of my background is I'm the product of a Jewish mother and a Franco-Ontarian father. That was kind of unusual in those days, but nowadays I could be considered typical Montreal. So my three brothers and I grew up in something of a crossroads of two cultures and religions. Mind you, neither of our parents were religious. But I think this upbringing in this sort of cross-cultural milieu kind of made us a bit more open-minded about people, cultures, and ideas. Also, my parents were extremely conscientious and hardworking. They set an example for all of us. And so we learned the value of education, was a big value, our parents' hard work and self-reliance. And my parents also, you know, appreciated their son's accomplishments. My mother kept a big and ever-thickening scrapbook of the different stages and significant events in the lives of each of her sons. When I was in high school, you know, after this discussion with my aunt, I decided I wanted to become an electronics engineer. And throughout high school, I enjoyed building projects of increasing complexity. Built a sound system for our house. I got into ham radio also. I was constantly on the lookout for cool, interesting gadgets that I could build. I got a kick out of making these things and also understanding how they worked. Even before I entered McGill, I had a pretty good basic understanding of electronics and general science also, but I had a pretty good basic understanding of electronics. And this practical knowledge was of great help to me at McGill. I was able to relate the more advanced theory that I was learning to my practical knowledge. And I became comfortable moving between the theoretical and practical domains, something that Mark mentioned about good scientists. They need to have some hands-on. And I think that ability to understand practical and theoretical has a lot to do with whatever I've been able to do in terms of being creative in my own field and somewhat with the success of my company. And ever since co-founding Matrox, what I enjoy the most doing there is participating in the conception of new product ideas. I love working at the junction between the rapidly evolving underlying technology, which in our industry is based fundamentally on Moore's law. It's not really a law, but it's an observation that the number of transistors on a chip doubles every couple of years. And how do you harness that increasing technological capability to practical opportunities in the marketplace? So I think that this combination of practical and theoretical knowledge, the ability to learn complex new concepts, which I learned at McGill as well, were things that enabled me to be successful. And it still gives me great pleasure. I still get the same kick when we take an idea from a conception of a product to a working prototype to a successful product in the marketplace. I get the same joy out of that as when I built my first crystal radio and I invited the whole neighborhood to come over and listen to this radio that I'd built.
So. Well, I think you showed great promise by building a radio.
Yeah.
Can you say what risks you've taken? Because obviously, what I associate with successful entrepreneurship or even unsuccessful entrepreneurship is that capacity to take risks. And you recall crucial moments along your career where something, somebody or something changed your life, changed your direction, led you where you are?
Well, I think the biggest risk obviously was the decision to leave the job I had at the time and
what was the job?
Go working at starting my own company with my partner.
What job did you leave?
I was working at a company called Marconi. Anyway, there were a couple of things that helped me out. I think the boss I had there was kind of nice to me, and he said, "Well, listen, if it doesn't work out, maybe we'll find a place for you. If you come back in a couple of years, well, he couldn't guarantee it." So that made me feel a little bit more willing to take the risk. But the fact of the matter was that I'd worked in a couple of places, and I'd gained some very valuable experience. By the way, it was very important to gain that practical experience of actually designing products. But, Marconi was a very large bureaucratic kind of an organization, and I saw myself as kind of just a small cog in that wheel. And, what could I do that would really kind of make a difference? And the idea of starting this company, and we had a couple of ideas of which direction we would take, just seemed very exciting, irresistible. So we took the plunge.
Historian Simon Rabinovich was born in Toronto in 1978. He got his undergraduate degree from McGill in History and Jewish Studies. He went on to Brandeis for his master's and PhD. He did a postdoc at the University of Florida, and he now teaches Jewish, European, and Russian history at Boston University. Please welcome the next generation, so to speak, Simon Rabinovich.
Well, first of all, I'd like to say congratulations, of course, to Professor Fauthier, and thank you for the great honor of inviting me to be on this panel as the next generation. I feel very humbled. I'm going to talk about a theme, focus on one theme in particular, about the circumstances in which creativity and knowledge meet. And it's actually very fitting. There's a lot of synergy with a number of things people have said, but Natalie actually directly addressed this in her talk, because what I want to talk about is freedom. Knowledge and creativity require freedom. And I'll explain in a minute just what I mean by freedom, but I'm going to first, like the rest of us, like the rest of you and all of us together, tell a short story. So as a child and as a teenager, I would say that I was a good enough student, but that I endured school rather than truly enjoyed it. But I was raised in a family where the spectrum of professional options went all the way from lawyer to doctor. And so it was an expectation that I attend university. And like any good teenager, I rebelled, and I wanted to be a pilot. And I said repeatedly, to become a pilot, right? To become a pilot, I need to go to flight school. There are colleges, technical colleges that you can go to for flight school. What do I need the liberal arts for? What do I need? What use is a degree, a Bachelor of Arts, going to do for me? And when I was in my final year of high school, and I seem to still be serious about this and not letting go and wanting to do this instead of university. My father sat me down for one of those memorable father-son conversations. And I say it was memorable because it's one of the few instances where I'm willing to admit that he was probably right. But he told me that university isn't just school. It's an experience. After university, you can do whatever you want. You can even go to flight school. Well, he actually said after law school, but anyway. But he said if you give up university, you're saying no thanks to what should really be the most enjoyable time of your life. And what really stuck with me until this day, and it's really something I regularly try to instill upon my students as much as possible, is when he said, you'll never again have that kind of freedom. And so this is what I want to emphasize in terms of where creativity and knowledge meet. Because they meet when there's freedom. And there are a number of different meanings to the word freedom, of course, and how this can be interpreted. And I didn't realize it at the time, but you know, my father didn't only mean freedom from him and freedom from my parents or freedom from the responsibilities of caring for a family and supporting a family, or even the freedom to choose truly any career that a person would want to have, although he certainly meant all of those things. But he also meant, he saw himself as an intellectual, and he also meant intellectual freedom. I tell my students this all the time, to think carefully about the classes they take in undergraduate, to take classes they want to take, because they'll spend the rest of their lives saying, I wish I had taken a class about that in university. And they have this freedom to explore any aspect of our society, our universe, and our culture. And it's the freedom associated with searching for answers to open questions, truly open questions. And this is what I figured out when I was in university, why university was so much more fun than high school. And I have a very short story to illustrate that, but when I was in high school, I had to write an essay. It almost seems cliche, but it was about Alexander the Great and I think it was reasons for his success or something to that effect. And I chose to write an essay that I thought was creative at the time, focusing on his horse and horses. I did not do well. And maybe I'm remembering things wrong. Maybe this essay was not the sophisticated and well-researched commentary on historical contingency that I felt it was at the time. But what I really remember feeling so clearly was that my answer did not fit among the options of already prescribed answers to this closed question. And, you know, there are perfectly valid reasons for high school pedagogy being set up the way it is. But for me, taking classes at McGill was an eye-opening experience because the questions were open and the potential answers were open. And it was the process of intellectual exploration that was important. And in the best classes, I should say, I had the freedom to explore and to interpret the significance of the historical, literary, or religious texts that lay before me. And I built knowledge in this creative process. So creativity and knowledge need freedom to thrive. But it's a different economic time now than it was in the late 1990s when I was a university student. And I had the freedom to take a risk. I had the freedom to pursue an academic career with unclear economic rewards or stability because I had a supportive wife or girlfriend at the time, as well as a financially comfortable family. But I was also given the freedom to chart my course as I went. And as my father had stressed, to choose my career after, not before, I had the maturity to do so.
So creativity and knowledge meet when students and faculty, artists, scientists, writers, engineers, architects, physicians, you name it, have the intellectual freedom to explore, the freedom to change directions, the freedom to acquire new knowledge. And this is something, as a faculty member now, serving on various inter-university committees with all sorts of professors from different fields, talking about pedagogy and talking about our research, that I appreciate more than ever. We're lucky enough that our students at McGill or in the United States have the freedom from poverty, the freedom from oppression, from restrictions on speech and belief. And this is the greatest advantage that education in liberal democracies has. But what I fear is in danger of eroding, and I hate to be the only one to to make this a cautionary tale, but is the sense among both students and scholars that their freedom to explore areas of intellectual creativity where the utility is not obviously apparent to them or their parents is starting to, hopefully not become more limited, but there's certainly more pressure to prove the utility first of what you're trying to achieve. And what McGill did for me was to awaken the realization that all scholarship is, in essence, the study of humankind and our universe, and it's all interconnected. And I think this is something, a point essentially all of us have made in our remarks. I have a couple of specific examples, McGill-related. One was that when I was in the residencies up on university, I walked by the Montreal Neurological Institute every day, and on the wall of the hospital, Wilder Penfield's dictum is written, "The problem of neurology is to understand man himself." I had to go make a drive-by today to make sure that I had remembered that correctly. But Wilder Penfield wasn't just a surgeon and a neurologist, although he was both of those things. He also wrote on the history of consciousness, books that my grandfather as a physician had on his bookshelves. And he even wrote a novel about Hippocrates that was set in ancient Greece. I took nearly all of my classes in the Stephen Leacock building, named, of course, after the author, who was one of the most famous satirists of the 20th century, one of the most famous literary figures of the 20th century. But what was Stephen Leacock doing at McGill? Not teaching literature. He was a professor of political economics. And these people, who were among the greatest names associated with this university, had the freedom and also the impulse to explore all aspects of human creativity and human societies. So when students today, worried as they are about the utility of their degree, ask me in my office, what can I do with a history degree? This is not a theoretical question. This is a question that I field every single day. Well, maybe not every single day, but let's say every single week. Or a BA, or a humanities degree, or whatever it is. I always answer them that they should understand everything and nothing, as little or as much as you want to do. First, you have to understand that you have the freedom to decide.
Thank you very much. In many ways, this has already been addressed, but I'll just open it to anyone who has additional comments to make about the relationship between Montreal and McGill, McGill and Montreal in the 21st century, if anybody wants to add to that.
I think that one of the aspects that I think is most important about McGill is its dedication to excellence. I think we've all talked about that in one way or another. I have the great good fortune to be, in a sense, coming home. I've spent most of my career outside of Canada, and I now have the responsibility of the McGill Chamber Orchestra, which is giving a concert tomorrow night right on this stage. If any of you have not already bought your tickets, please come. Marie-José Lave, who's a wonderful soprano, is going to be our guest artist, and we have a wonderfully young and enthusiastic orchestra that is full of energy and full of inspiration. But I think being associated with McGill for me is excellence, is that dedication to excellence. And you mentioned on it earlier about Leacock, and it is that which we have to guard most important. McGill is universally known as the finest university in Canada. No matter what anybody says anywhere else, I think it is. I feel very fortunate to be part of that now here in Montreal. We're celebrating our 75th anniversary as an orchestra. In a way, I owe my beginnings to McGill. My parents met as a result of an opening in the string quartet, which my mother applied for, and she got more than just the job.
So there are two of us that owe our existence to the university.
Yeah. What's your McGill parentage story?
My mother was waiting for a bus, apparently, I think on Sherbrooke Street, and I guess a flirtation. The bad part of the story was the first time they came to visit me at McGill, and we walked under the walkway connecting Redpath and McConnell libraries, and they started laughing. I was like, okay, what's going on? And they said, oh, this is where it was raining. They went out, geez, I don't know what they went out for. But anyway, it was raining, and this was sheltered, and this was where my father proposed to my mother. So, yeah, you say, except it ruined, you know, that sort of walk every day. Vivid imagery.
I mean, you were saying that McGill is an excellent university, and I certainly agree with that. I got a little personal anecdote to relate to that. When I was in high school, I was one of the top students in math and science in my high school. I actually went to Baron Bing, which I don't know if anybody knows. It was that place, famous high school that a lot of alumni came from. But so I came to McGill very confident. But when I entered my first year of university, I was in for quite a shock. In high school, I was one of the best, probably the best male student at that school. But when I got to McGill in first year engineering, I was surrounded by the brightest students from Quebec, Canada, and from many parts of the world. And that was quite a shock. And I had to work really hard to keep up with them. In engineering, I think it's well known that they really make you work your ass off. The subject matter is quite complex. And when you're trying to master very complex subjects with the brightest minds, you have to work really hard. So that was one of the habits I learned from McGill. And I had a bit of trouble adapting to it at the beginning. But when I got into my stride, it was something that I showed that I could compete with the best and I could master the most complex material if I really worked at it. And that's something, a value that helped me with my career later on. So, there you go.
And I think already in Suzanne Fortier's very short tenure so far, she has declared ambitiously, strongly, and bravely the university's relationship with the city and with the province by speaking out on behalf of the McGill community against the charter that would so limit the opportunities that exist within the city and the province. So I congratulate you for that as well. And thank you very much to the panel, all of you, and I believe you have some closing remarks. Okay.
Alors, j'aimerais remercier Eleanor et tous les membres du panel, vraiment pour une conversation tellement stimulante, inspirante, intéressante. It is wonderful to hear your reflection on the meeting of knowledge and creativity. Of course, your words will stay with me for a long, long time, and I will. I hope I'll have the opportunity to hear them again, actually, and to reflect more profoundly on them. But let me just say a few small summaries here. The insatiable curiosity that Lauren talked to us about, that curiosity to learn about our world, and it's so inspiring because, of course, we know so little about the world. And that is something that is very important to me. Now, it's wonderful, though, to hear from Brad that actually we start learning not from the day we're born, but the day we're conceived. And so that's an important thing here, I think. The art of the start. Now, wait a minute. That is something indeed that what to start with, the problem you start with, the work that you start with is so important. And Mark, I will want to have a conversation with you. You know, I'm only 2 months in the job, and so the art of the start has a special meaning to me tonight. And so let's spend some time here to talk about it. The freedom that you talked about, Natalie, and the giving people the freedom to be creative, and I like that word, creative, which means mix the creativity and the action. And of course, that's what you've given us in Montreal with all your work here in the museum. And I must say, that I will always remember, Simon, the important message that you had for us, giving our students, our professors, everybody who are members of our university, the intellectual freedom to explore and to search for answers to open questions. Now, I have to tell you, there's an expression that will never mean the same for me anymore. You know, when we talk about being of two minds, well, Julie has told us that being of two minds can be actually quite exciting. It is that mix of the creative mind and the Cartesian mind. So from now on, I'm going to try very hard to be of two minds. Merci beaucoup, vous tous. On va continuer la conversation avec les membres du panel, entre nous aussi, entre amis, entre collègues. On s'en va à la verrière, qui est dans le bâtiment de l'autre côté de la rue, mais je pense qu'on va passer par en dessous. Hein. On a un passage souterrain qui est pas très secret et qui va nous donner la chance aussi de pouvoir voir ces belles toiles, des belles images qui va stimuler notre imagination. Alors, on va se diriger vers la verrière. Inquiétez-vous pas si vous n'avez pas vraiment le sens de l'orientation. There will be people guiding us. And so they'll take us to la verrière. Et que le plaisir continue. Merci beaucoup.